This week on the Eldritch Lorecast,
Darrington Press has a game called Daggerheart.
Chit chat, dice time.
Daggerheart is going into an open playtest.
Be mindful of the culture that surrounds anything the Critical Role puts out.
Wizards of the Coast, they are going all in on maps, baby!
It's better, but not better for me.
Vecna, nest of the Eldritch Eye.
Couldn't buy it. I'm just a grumpy old man now.
That's right. NASA have released a tabletop RPG product.
Bubba Booey, all that and more right now.
three, two, one. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number one reheated news tabletop RPG podcast in all the realms. That's right. It's time for your cold spaghetti made hot again. By popping it in the microwave, putting it on 2.5 minutes, make sure you take the tin foil off or it might explode, but not this week because we have safely applied the reheating process to the news of the tabletop RPG
Ben,
world.
You're anyway. Going so good.
My name's Ben Byrne. That is the voice of James Hake, Dale Kingsmill, Sean Merwin. We are all here. Welcome. Welcome one and all. And Sean, I have to ask you a question that mm-hmm. has been sent to us by Sean, of a different ilk, I assume. That's Sean asking, if you had to re-coin the term tabletop RPG to something that you deemed more fitting, what would you change that term to describe the games?
I would not change it because I think it very much describes exactly what happens. What I would do is change what we call video role-playing games so we can drop the tabletop and we can just say, this is a game in which we play roles and that thing you do on your console or on your phone or on your tablet or on your computer, that is not a role-playing game. That is a video something, something, something. And role-playing games belong on the tabletop, and therefore it is redundant to say tabletop.
What would you do to the LARPers?
Oh, boy. You know, this is a family show, and you know, things like that are not your dope. No, just kidding. I love LARPers.
Okay. No, all right. No, that's fair. That's fine. That's cool.
Wouldn't do anything. They're a live-action role-playing game distinct from a unqualified role-playing game.
Our dead role-playing game.
And this doesn't have a G in it.
Yeah.
They're not LARPers.
That's true. That's true. They're just live. So is there no game aspect to it?
That's because it isn't a game, Ben.
Okay.
Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Well, Dale Kingsmill, do you have a name that you would change tabletop role-playing games to?
I similarly don't think that I would change it. I don't think there's, you know, much in the vein of, you know, an FPS first-person shooter in video games or a real-time strategy game. I think that these are signals not to people outside of the gaming community so much as they are signals to people inside the community so that you could like put a little flag on it and say this is the type of this is the method of play you will be engaging in. This is the expected sort of core game loop for this type of game rather than expecting the genre. Portal is as much of a first person shooter as Halo or Call of Duty. But if I was forced to change the name of TTRPGs, I would call them Chit Chat Dice Time.
I love it.
Okay, I like that. Yeah. CCDT, that's what we're going with. James Hake, what about your very fine self?
I'm inspired by what the Japanese do, which is kind of a common refrain in my life, but I recently learned from a video that the Asians Represent podcast did. They investigated Yellow Submarine RPG Shop in Akihabara, Tokyo, that a lot of indie tabletop RPGs in Japan are called table talk role-playing games, which I think is very delightful. And I think it is pretty descriptive of what we do. We do sit at a table and we do talk and we do role-play games.
It does feel that tabletop RPGs, in the spirit of the question from Sean, I think it's accurate as well. I wouldn't change it. But I think that's because of the way that I play tabletop RPGs. It very much involves the tabletop with miniatures and the grid. And it kind of, you know, combat looks a little bit more and maybe plays a little bit more like a board game than necessarily every role-playing game or everybody's way of playing, you know, the more popular role-playing games like D&D. So, yeah, I wouldn't change it either. But there, I think Table Talk is just as applicable, especially for specific games.
Except, you know, Alice is Missing.
I was about to say, that's a table text role-playing game.
True.
A table, don't you dare talk.
Speaking of Alice is Missing and daring not to speak, the new Dagger, I don't know why my brain just like left my body then. It just went whoop out of my body. I'm going to take that again and Dante's going to leave it in. Speaking, oh no, nah. Let me just recover this
Ben,
a bit.
We've
you know what, James,
you out.
Lead us in.
Speaking of, I can't do it.
Speaking of Alice is Missing, the creator of Alice is Missing did work for Darrington Press. And Darrington Press has a game called Daggerheart.
And in fact, it's the same guy leading design on both. That's Spencer Stark, who also led design on Candela Obscura for Darrington Press, also leading their fantasy RPG, Daggerheart. All right, there we go. We got through it. We managed it.
We got there. We've introed the topic. Daggerheart is going into an open playtest period, which is starting on March 12th, where you will be able to access the playtest rules for Daggerheart via the Darrington website. We'll apparently have them published up there. But you can also access them through Demiplane, which I believe is going to have the kind of character sheet, character creator there as well, I would imagine. Especially because these character sheets are specific and use cards to kind of construct the sheet. I imagine having a digital companion will be very helpful for some folks. And it will also be available in physical playtest at participating game stores. So if you want to see the physical cards, pop down to your friendly local game store and ask if they're running playtests there. Feedback to be provided via the Daggerheart website. Are we excited?
I am excited. It's exciting to get playtests for something new. Particularly after quite a long stretch of all the playtest material that I was looking at being all for 5.5. You know, getting some playtest stuff for MCDM, getting some playtest stuff for Daggerheart. Yes, good. Good. It's like breathing fresh oxygen.
It feels like role-playing games have entered the early access stage of kind of their lifespan as an industry.
I had the good fortune to be able to play Daggerheart late last year and build a character and stuff like that. And I got to say two things. One is that I had an amazing time playing it. And two, it's a game in its alpha state. I think that, you know, just like the grace to develop we've given the MCDM RPG, the tough love that some of us have given the MCDM RPG, that's exactly the attitude that Daggerheart needs right now. And I can't help but be mindful of the culture that surrounds anything that Critical Role puts out, which is by no fault of the company. typically a very sort of all or nothing mindset, right? Where either it's God's gift to man, or it is the root of all evil at the heart of this industry. And I just want to encourage people to come into this game, which I had a great time playing and found frequent fault in, both small and large, to, you know, approach it in that spirit. Because I think if you look at it as a game in progress and a game that you want to be better, again, like, you have an opportunity to do that, right? People on social media often, there's this refrain of do better, right? Be better, which generally is used as a way to shut down conversation. But in this situation, I really want to urge people to take a be better mindset as a way to expand conversation. How could this be better? Because they want it to be better. People are listening, and the desire of any playtest is to make it better.
And they're doing a great job of getting it out there, right? It's not like it's hidden on some small website that you have to have a secret handshake to find. This is, go to a store, go to this site, go to DriveThru, go to Darrington's website, go to Demiplane. You can find it everywhere. And they've already told you how to give feedback. It's right. So give that feedback. Give it honestly, but as James said, give it in good faith.
Yeah, yeah. They've asked for that sort of feedback as well. They're in their press releases have been saying, we need your help to break the game because we want to, you know, mold it into something that they can be truly proud of. So they're not shy about wanting the constructive criticism. I think the constructive is the other key word in there, you know, just being cognizant. Maybe being cognizant as some other people maybe haven't as much in the past, that there are game designers on the other end of these games and, you know, just being constructive in your criticism.
Well, it is also, I think, don't only be self-aware in the things that you're saying, also be aware in your reactions to other people's reactions.
Sure.
Mm. Because as a person who loves things by criticizing them and changing them, you know, I watch my favorite TV shows and I think, that season could have been better. Let's write some fan fiction. I think, oh, I love D&D. Wouldn't it be great if, you know, there was some kind of an exploration system that actually worked? You know, I that's how I love things. But people often react to that with the assumption that I must not love the thing that I'm talking about. There's a lot of the thing where it's like, well, then clearly this game isn't for you, so go play something else.
Sure.
Let's reserve a little bit of that kind of reaction as well while people are playtesting and expressing their opinions about this. If we can be constructive in our opinions about this, we can be constructive in our reactions to the reactions.
Ben, is the playtest material for Daggerheart out right now? Is it public?
No, not yet, I don't believe. March 12th is when that becomes public, I believe on Demiplane, their website. I assume stores, just get in contact with your friendly local game store. I'm assuming in the US, I believe, and you might know more about this, James, that there's like the Darrington Press Guild that game stores can kind of volunteer themselves to be part of.
I'll be right back, Ben.
Ooh.
Resolution.
It's a cool game.
Look at that.
These are cards.
This is the good stuff.
These are cards they had public at Gen Con, so they're pretty out of date.
Yes.
Yeah. I was warned by the Darrington people when I was there.
Don't show these to anyone.
Show in public.
Basically, just that they're out of date. Yeah, sorry. I'm gonna tease you like that. I'm looking at the cards right now.
Please.
I'm like, maybe I shouldn't do that on camera.
No, I want to know.
What's interesting, just somebody brought up in the chat, they didn't do any sort of open playtest period for Candela Obscura. And Darrington really kind of doing their own thing. I would be surprised at this point if there is a crowd fund for Daggerheart. They've said that they're doing this playtest period. The game is coming in 2025. So the 1.0 release will be next year from what they've said so far. And I imagine that it's just going to be a drop kind of, you know, it's released, it's launched kind of thing, as opposed to doing like a campaign run up to it and then printing it later, at a guess. But it's just not, you know, everybody's kind of doing their own thing. And I think the reason there wasn't a playtest for Candela and there is for Daggerheart is because, I don't know, maybe they considered it more necessary, or maybe they just want to get the community more involved. A way to get the community involved early in a project before release without needing to do a crowdfunding kind of solution to it. So
I don't know stuff like that. I hesitate to speculate.
If anybody wants a refresher of the rules after Gen Con, or at least us kind of loosely talking about our understanding of them, episode 98 of the Lorecast is the episode where we last talked about Daggerheart in any sort of detail. And I remember back then feeling, and I might be repeating myself a little bit, a little conflicted about the card setup of the character sheets. I understand it's intended to be easy access for folks, not needing to flick through a big book to find rules because your cards are kind of all laid out in front of you. The flip side of that is that the character sheet to me feels like it would probably be like a, you know, kind of assembled delicately on the table in front of you, and you need to tape it down to make sure things aren't sliding everywhere constantly.
Well, boy, do I have good news for you, Ben.
Okay, go ahead.
Because you saw it at Gen Con, right? You saw the cards.
Not in person.
I never
saw it in person, no.
Well, the stuff that was shown at Gen Con, because I didn't see it in person either. I only saw it at that Polygon article that came out around that time, where they had a landscape style character sheet that you place the cards gingerly upon. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was very attractive, but the people at at Darrington, as you'll see in the playtest coming up, had the same idea as you, Ben, which is that it's all a bit difficult. So when I play tested it with them, the character sheet became portrait style again, and the cards became sort of, you know, a sideboard.
See, this is, I started out on Ben's side of the fence. I was like, oh, I like the cards, but I feel like it's going to get messy quickly. And then I started thinking that the actual, like, the greatest benefit of doing it as a set of cards is that you can rearrange them as you see fit. You can put the information where you naturally look for it. You can spread it out really skinny around your dice tray. You can, you know, set it up however you want it. And I think that, to me, is like the greatest, like, good thing to get out of a character sheet that is made of individual cards. I'm actually a little bit surprised at the idea that they would have a character sheet and the cards.
I don't know how much I should talk about my experience with it. I need to wait till
I
need to wait till their playtest is out. I don't want to scoop them, you know?
Yeah. What this brings to mind to me is for a beta test like this, we're talking about, we haven't even discussed the 2D12. What this game needs right now is stress test. It needs you to play the basic game loop over and over and over and over in every different way that you can. And don't get lost in the cool doodads and knickknacks and the way that it makes you feel when you see it. Because that's important. But how you feel when you see it will pale in comparison to what you feel when you're on your 72nd game and you're rolling the dice or having to switch the cards one more time. And you're just like, I don't want to do this anymore. Go. So focus on that as a playtester. It's cool to talk about all this stuff, obviously, but keep that in mind too when you go into this with your eyes wide open.
Rel is asking in chat whether Critical Role have made it known whether they're going to shift away from D&D and into Daggerheart for their streamed campaigns. No idea. I don't think they've said. We had Luna on last week who was kind of saying that they don't know either. Luna from the LaBoffin YouTube channel, if you want to go check it out. But I would be shocked if there wasn't a live stream game kind of demonstrating how to play Candela. In fact, I'd like one sooner rather than later, kind of based on the beta. Even if it's just a one session kind of thing where they're like showing it off. In fact, now that I'm saying that, I feel like I remember reading that they were doing something soon, but I can't remember, so I don't want to speak off the cuff.
I saw the Bob World Builder did a YouTube video about playing Daggerheart combat, so I no longer have compunctions against talking a little bit about my favorite part of Daggerheart. And it's about its hit points. I think Daggerheart's hit points are really cool. There's this sense that they want to have their cake and eat it too when it comes to big, exciting damage values and small, easily trackable health values. Daggerheart has this kind of, it has a system of hit points and stress. Stress is typically used as a currency to do like cool stuff, extra stuff, push yourself to do more on your turn. This is not a new concept. Game's been doing this for a while. But its hit points are typically broken down into, I don't remember off the top of my head, but probably only like maybe 6 or 7 hit points, something like that. However, based on one of your ability scores, you have these damage thresholds, or it might be your armor value or something like that. It's changed between playtests, as far as I'm aware. There is a value that is essentially what is a mild wound, a moderate wound, and a severe wound. And so when you roll to hurt someone, if you surpass their mild, but their, you know, their 1 point damage threshold, let's call them 5, 10, and 15, right? 5 is mild damage, 10 is medium damage, 3 is severe damage. If you, or 15 is severe damage. So if you pass 5, you deal 6 damage, it becomes 1 hit points worth of damage on their character sheet. If you deal 11 through 15 points of damage, it becomes 2 hit points on their sheet. If you deal 15 or more, it becomes 3 points of damage on their sheet. And if you don't clear that first threshold, it's tracked as a point of stress instead. And this is all stuff that I get the sense wants to create those big exciting moments at the table that you see in shows like Critical Role, right? You love hearing people shout out 38 damage, blah, 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 blah. It's way more, you know, exciting from a presentational standpoint than saying, and we just dealt 3 damage. Yeah, right. So you can see where the sort of desires of streaming are finding ways to work together with the desires of, I would guess Spencer Stark, who likes these fairly straightforward, streamlined, manageable mechanical systems. And there are other interactions with it, like with armor, that I don't want to get overcomplicated here talking about this nugget of a system that I really like, but I think it serves as a powerful core for making good decisions at the table, how you find ways to mitigate the incoming damage so you can pop it down to a lower tier or something like that.
Can I ask you, and this might be a bit of a banal question or a bit of a simplified question, but can I ask you, in terms of level of sophistication or crunch in the system, how it compares to something like 5e and how it also compares against its probably other main competitor at the moment in the space, being the MCDM game. The MCDM game being, to my perception, kind of a bit more, if not crunchy, specific in its rulings compared to 5e, which can be a bit more like, you know, sure, this kind of works. Versus something that's kind of like Candela Obscura, where it's quite open to creating things in the moment.
My experience was that it was, it felt more customizable than fifth edition and a little bit less complicated in flight. I don't know. When people see the material, yeah, that's the danger with answering these questions, is my answers are probably going to be months out of date. So I'm excited about this stuff, but I'm honestly just as excited as we all are here to see what has changed between when I saw it kind of in fall and winter of last year versus what we're all going to see this spring.
Speaking of seeing, Aquella Gabriel has just backed us up in chat, saying to celebrate the launch of the open playtest beta, the cast of Critical Role will live stream a special Daggerheart one shot on Tuesday, March 12th, 7 p.m. Pacific on Twitch and YouTube. So if you want to see the game in flight before trying it out yourself, or even after trying it out yourself, I suppose, maybe not after, because that might be hard. I don't know, maybe if you watch the VOD. Anyway, I'm rambling.
I know it won't be, but I hope the logo is one of those old school tattoos of a heart with a dagger in it.
I mean, we know what the logo is, right?
Okay, well, you all know what the logo is. I don't pay attention to anything.
Wizards of the Coast, they are going all in on maps, baby! They released a video recently talking about new updates that they have brought to maps over the last few weeks, months, little while, including new features like a spectator mode so the DM can kind of see it from the player's perspective while logged into D&D Beyond. They don't need to create a separate player account plugged into the same campaign to be able to see it from the player's perspective. Draw tools, which seem super handy, especially if you're working with a blank canvas and you just want to draw like a wall and this is a tree and stuff if you don't want to load in a map. Renaming tokens seems super handy as well to give monsters names, possibly track health, track individual monsters. They touted third-party support, mentioning Lairs of Aetheris, Dungeons of Drakenheim, and Humblewood recently coming. And just kind of, I think the main takeaway from this small news story, as much as it is news apart from the updates, is like, maps is here to stay. Like, they're going in on it. It kind of snuck out as something that they put on the platform without the grand announcement that the 3D VTT got. And yet it seems, at least to me, the far more pragmatic virtual tabletop product that more people will be able to use more easily and is probably actually more useful for running most games of D&D.
I cannot argue with that. Just to be clear, unless I've heard otherwise, are very likely still working on their virtual tabletop. There hasn't been any change of direction. There's just been more focus on maps recently, as Ben said. And I think it's going to be two different things. I think it's very much going to be, do I want to run with a pen and a grid, or do I want to buy Dwarven Forge and build something really cool that my players will love? So I don't see these competing with each other in any way. And part of me is sad that Maps is being updated. And so far, they haven't done anything. Yeah, spectator mode, great. Very handy for DMs. Yeah, make make Fog of War easier to clear away. Perfect. Rename tokens. Absolutely. I fear the day when they really start integrating it with D&D Beyond, and you have to connect character to a token, and you have to connect a monster to it. Right. When we get to that point where it becomes a programmatic thing to use rather than just an easy thing to use, that's when it's no longer useful to me. I love it the way it is. There might be a couple of things that when I use, I might say, oh, it'd be nice if, but I can use it exactly as it is. And I hope if they do continue to push maps toward becoming a more full feature virtual tabletop, that they make a way to leave it simple.
I had the exact same experience with Owlbear Rodeo a little while ago.
I was going to bring that up.
Early Owlbear Rodeo was so simple and so spare, so Spartan, and it was perfect for what I needed it for, which was to put down a map and some custom minis. And they've upgraded it, but I don't want to use it anymore. It's better, but not better for me.
The melancholia in your tone just now. But it's not better for me.
VTTs are hard, and this might make me sound old. I'm not sure. But VTTs, for me, there is a very fine line, and I think that Sean and James are both kind of touching on it, a very fine line between a VTT adding to your tabletop experience or detracting from your tabletop experience, particularly when it comes to game master prep. Because one thing that I get a little bit in my head about when I'm using a VTT is finding a map, a fully realized artistic map, whether it's through a Patreon that I'm supporting at the time. I did a lot of that through lockdowns, or, you know, whether it's sourcing it from the adventure itself or wherever it comes from, finding a map, decorating the map, setting up the 3D lighting or the fog of war kind of lighting, if the map allows for that sort of thing. And it can add to GM prep in a way, and then interfacing with the VTT on top of just trying to run the game itself, it very easily becomes cumbersome in a way that makes me not want to use it, because it's much quicker and easier for me to throw miniatures down on a table than it is to
well, it's interesting because we start from a place like the idea of them continuing to develop their sort of 3D fancy virtual tabletop, and at the same time, you know, increasing the features on this sort of more 2D based maps system. It recognizes that there are two different kinds of people who want to use virtual tabletops.
Yeah.
You know, yes, sure, we can make this very fancy thing, but they've probably heard lots of us say, well, that's going to be for like the streamers and stuff. That's going to be for these fancy people. I don't know why I keep characterizing them as fancy, but that's in my head.
In
they're
the
all wearing
ivory
like
towers
hats and monocles.
Oh, we're the streamers.
Oh, yeah, that's very near virtual tabletop. But then on the other end, you've got people who just are looking for a practical, literally a virtual tabletop.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be fancy, you know. And so there's this recognition, but at the same time, it's very difficult to figure out where the line between those two groups is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a fairly fuzzy field, and you can, yeah, start adding features. Being able to see what your players are seeing, that's a great feature to have. That's really useful and important, sure. Being able to draw on the map, yes, that's useful. But where do you stop adding features? Because where does it become too much for the simpletons who don't have monocles? you know, it's a tricky job, but I don't know. I think they've still got a little bit of wiggle room yet.
Yeah. I agree that line, because Owlbear Rodeo found that line, right, and then crossed it, because James is not the only one that I've heard say Owlbear Rodeo used to be fantastic for what it did, and now it's gone from that point of making running the game easier to making running the game a little bit harder or more cumbersome or whatever the situation is. And so I agree with Sean that I hope that map stays simple. Keep maps simple. Do we think, this is like just complete wild speculation, but do we think that maps might have been more popular than they thought it would be?
I would like to see the numbers. It is an interesting theory.
I would be delighted if that were true. You know, that would be very like sports movie of it. the underdog, Maps, coming in and hitting a grand slam with the D&D fans.
Here's an interesting tidbit for you. Vecna, mm-hmm. nest of the Eldritch Eve, nest of the Eldritch Eye, is a one-shot adventure for levels 3 to 4 that is a lead-in to Vecna, Eve of Ruin.
Eknave.
That is releasing through D&D Beyond, much as they've done their little supplements over the past kind of 2 years now. Some of them have been really great, whether they've been free or whether they've been, you know, like the D&D Beyond movie characters, I think was a free supplement off the top of my head, or whether they've been sort of like microtransaction-y. Vecna, Nest of the Eldritch Eye is an adventure that is only available on D&D Beyond if you pre-order Eve of Ruin and will not be available forever after. You must pre-order Eve of Ruin to get this extra adventure.
And seeing this news, I went to pre-order it. And I thought, I'll pre-order the book and the D&D Beyond, because why not? I'm going to collect it. So I clicked it on D&D Beyond, and it sent me to a different website. Okay, I could deal with that. I had to log into that website. It was the Wizards website. And then I also had a previous thing I was going to purchase already in the cart. So I tried to get rid of that, but I clicked on the little delete can and it wouldn't delete. And I tried to click on the you must accept the terms to do this, and that wouldn't click and check when I clicked it, so I couldn't buy it. I'm just a grumpy old man now. You'll have to excuse me. That was just my rant.
There's a gremlin in the website trying to save you. Don't do it, Sean! Don't do it!
And then I went back to D&D Beyond and thought, I'll just buy the D&D Beyond version. But when I clicked it, it didn't say, if you buy this, you also get Nest of the Eldritch Eye / Eve. I didn't want to buy it without knowing for sure that that's what I needed to buy, because on the other site, it did say, if you buy this, you will get Nest of the Eldritch Eye. So I'm just confused now. I get off my lawn, clouds, whole thing.
Maybe something they want to work on.
I don't see anything about this anywhere on D&D Beyond. And let me just say, Nest of the Eldritch Eye starting April 16th. I kind of expected it would be here now. I kind of expected that when they announced that I get this little pre-order bonus, given what D&D Beyond has done with their little digital content bonuses before, it would be, you know, dropped as it was announced, Beyonce style.
April 14th for Nest of the Eldritch Eye.
Okay.
And May 21st for the actual book.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe
well,
that's
this pre-order says Nest of the Eldritch Eye April 16th and early access to Eve of Ruin digitally on May 7th. So these dates are just all over the place.
Good. Well, all of this discussion is giving me flashbacks to like buying concert tickets through Ticketek and then having to work through their help system where it's like, we're not sending you the tickets until the day before the concert. And I'm like, but they were a gift for someone else. Please, please, for the love of God, if you can get your hands on it, if you can find wherever the Eve of Ruin is, it's just one session. You level up at the end of it. That's cute. I like that. I think that's a great way of hooking new players into the game. I think that's a really easy, good idea. And maybe actually it should be more accessible than just for maybe people who pre-order maybe through D&D Beyond.
Well, as Mackenzie says from the D&D Beyond or the D&D, the Wizards of the Coast design team, Vecna is a god of secrets. And so accessing this adventure is a secret you must first uncover.
All ingrained.
The adventure itself does seem cool, though, like this kind of murder mystery linked to a greater conspiracy, linked to one of D&D's greatest villains. The description of the adventure sounds cool. I will say that.
I'm surprised you guys have been so easy on this Nest of the Eldritch Eye release strategy, because I actually hate it. I usually like to play the
voice. You read us as being easier?
yeah, honestly.
Maybe you don't have Ticketek in America, because I compared it to
you know,
Ticketek.
That's fair. I don't go to very many concerts, so you're talking in an arena I'm not familiar with. What this reminds me of is something that Nintendo did a couple of years ago for the 35th anniversary or something of Super Mario Bros., where they had all of these games that were for the anniversary. We're re-releasing Mario 64 and Sunshine and Galaxy in one package. We're releasing Super Mario 35, which is a sort of battle royale thing. And then at the end of the month, you no one will ever be able to buy them ever again. You can still play them, but you won't be able to buy them ever again. And so it's this sort of like, you know, this false scarcity thing that they're that games companies are playing with as a way to leverage FOMO to increase profits. And it's like, this is my perennial frustration with Wizards, is I adore the stuff they create, and I'm constantly frustrated at how they get it to you, at how they market it, at the business of it. It infuriates me that this is how we're getting, like, you know, the prequel to the adventure, right? Something that, you know, even if it's not a core part of the story, should be some kind of DLC, right? At least with DLC, you can buy it whenever. I don't see what this is going to do other than, like, promote piracy.
Deus is often, you know, commenting on Wizards videos and things whenever, or tweeting at them whenever they do one of these releases through D&D Beyond, saying, where is the PDF version? A PDF version would be really helpful for people. They could print it out. They could, you know, do different things with it. But, you know, piracy is difficult if it's kind of hardwired into the D&D Beyond software, you know. I guess you could just, like, scan your page or whatever, like you know, screen cap and share it maybe. But not that I'm promoting that idea. Please don't do that. Piracy is not – I do not support piracy. You know, the fact that it's hardwired into the D&D Beyond system is – helping to prevent that issue. Anyway, moving on.
Kairos is as a form of rhetoric, which is, you know, it has to be now, time is running out. Yeah. That kind of method of convincing people has been like a mainstay tactic within marketing for probably as long as marketing has existed. But the thing that I think James is right, there's this element of it where it's like, yeah, but you can, when it's a physical item and you say while stocks last, that makes sense. But if it's a digital thing, that we see through that. That's a lie. What do you mean? No, you're not running out of it. You're just stopping selling it to me. Versus something like, hey, for this window of time, it's going to be this special deal. You're going to get 20% off or whatever, right? Or, you know, the fact that it is bundled with something. For this window of time, you can get it as a bundle with the pre-order. After that, you have to buy it separately. Yeah. You know what I mean? That still accesses that kind of thinking, that FOMO thinking, without doing the same thing of being like, and you can never get it again.
Other thing to say is they may need these pre-orders. They may be trying to incentivize people to pre-order rather than buy it after it comes out because they need the money. And so they're really trying to incentivize people to pre-order, which is sad because, you know, Wizards of 10 years ago would have just been, hey, here's a free adventure that leads into this. Have fun and hopefully you'll buy it.
If y'all remember Death House from Curse of Strahd, the prologue adventure to that one, they just released that for free as a PDF.
Yeah. That's a good example, actually.
Tis. I had forgotten.
They've released a few extra details about Vecna, Eve of Ruin. Confirming settings will visit Eberron, Dragonlance, Ravenloft, Greyhawk, Planescape, the Nine Hells, and Spelljammer. Will all be the settings that they will revisit as you collect the seven pieces of the seven rod to put it together to fight Vecna. I think it was either Dicebreaker or it was Wargamer. I'm going to say it was Dicebreaker. I had an article where they were like, it feels very Avengers Endgame, where, you know, you're doing a victory lap through the previous settings that they've released in 5th edition, which, yeah, is a cool thing, I suppose. It's a little highfalutin for me, only because I like my grounded dark.
Get your monocles.
Fantasy settings. But is anybody excited for the adventure? Sean, are you excited to play or at least read through Eve of Ruin?
I am excited to see how everyone reacts to it, particularly because it's high level. For those folks who want high level play or feel that the reason there aren't high level characters is because there's no high level content to test that felonious theory. Felonious? No. What's the word I'm looking for?
Erroneous?
Erroneous.
Erroneous.
Yeah.
Moses supposes his toes are roses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. erroneously.
Moses supposed this feloniously. Get him! Fallacious was another possibility mm-hmm. given in chat. That's yes. also a good word.
That's what I was probably thinking.
Speaking of news, let's just take a neutral tone for this next one. Speaking of broader tabletop RPG news, there is another lawsuit within the tabletop Woo! RPG industry coming from Sean Thomas against Geek Therapeutics. There's a little bit of background to understand with this one. I will slam through it, hopefully as informatively as I can. Sean Thomas is a therapeutic GM who has filed a lawsuit against Geek Therapeutics, which is an organization that trains and certifies specialists in the use of therapeutic geek culture. I believe this includes, but is not limited to, using D&D and tabletop role-playing games in a therapeutic capacity. But I think from their website, they might also deal in like video games and things like that. Thomas developed Realms of Chimoria, which is a campaign setting, and began licensing negotiations with Geek Therapeutics to create a 5e supplement for it. Realms of Chimoria, a 5e adventure setting, currently has a backer kit campaign going, I believe. And this setting is intended or aims to be accessible for folk who are neurodiverse or have dyslexia. However, during the OGL crisis, Thomas became a little bit concerned about need, because it's a 5e compatible setting, about needing to pay royalties to Wizards of the Coast under the new license that they wanted to use. And so despite the fact that a licensing agreement between Sean Thomas and Geek Therapeutics was never finalized, Thomas is alleging that Geek Therapeutics went ahead with a crowdfunding campaign that they are not happy with, and also claims that Geek Therapeutics has misrepresented Thomas personally in emails sent to backers, or an email sent to backers. Bit of a sticky situation. Will be interesting to see how it plays out. Does anybody else have thoughts, comments, details I might have missed?
Technically, I believe the allegation isn't that they started a Kickstarter in spite of the blah, blah, blah. The allegation is that there was not a finalized license. Yeah. That's what it's going to hinge on. Because I mean, it feels a little bit like stupid and oversimplified to say, but either there's going to be a paper trail that says actually there was an agreement and a license was made and sure. they do have the right to do this, even if it ends up being a little bit scummy in practice, they legally would be allowed to do it. Or there's not going to be enough evidence to say that they did that. And there's, you know what, it's going to be one or the other of those things. It is interesting that he's also, sort of looped in with it is a case of libel and slander with the suggestion that they sent an email. I was reading a little bit deeper. The allegation seems to be that they sent an email pretending to be Sean Thomas, giving support for the project, which is very interesting. It's also interesting because libel and slander are different things. Libel is, of course, written, you know, things that damage the character of a person, and slander being things that are said. And so those, I haven't seen much that is talking about this slander case. I've seen stuff that would apply to the libel and to the copyright case, but not to the slander. The other thing that's a very minor correction, based on my deeper reading, it seems like Sean Thomas, it was less about a concern for the royalties that might have to be paid potentially under the, at the time, you know, controversial, OGL situation. Sure, sure. And more about the potential loss of IP, I guess, personal IP. Yes. That idea that Worlds of Chimoria is their setting that they've created, but once you publish it using this 5e agreement, that then Wizards of the Coast would have access to that and some measure of control over that if they wanted it, which does seem to be at the heart of their complaint here as well. They, in the discussions about possibly publishing this setting, there was a lot of talk about who would retain the rights to the setting. I don't know. It's a little tricky. The stuff that came out of, what was it called? The IDC, was a little bit, lacking in details. I would love more details, but also I guess we're just going to have to see how it unfolds.
Open World Addict sent us an email asking, how can you learn, how much can you learn about running different types of D&D campaigns by only reading published adventures? Is it worth purchasing published adventures just to read them, even if you never plan to run the adventure necessarily? Can you form bad habits or bad ways of thinking from reading published adventures?
I'm fascinated by this question because as designers often say, you know, designing for publication and designing for home play are very different, right? So if we follow that framework, can running from pre-published and running from your notes be extremely different? And I think the difference is mostly academic. When it comes from the DM or the GM running the material, it's mostly in how married are you to the text of the adventure versus how married are you to the notes you've created, right? Because when I run from a published book, I tend to be pretty married to the book because I commit the cardinal sin of not reading ahead. I don't look at what's coming next. And if I don't follow things relatively closely to what's going on, I run the risk of accidentally contradicting myself when the text doesn't zag in the way I expected it to. Whereas when I run from my notes, I can be as, you know, as improvisational and creative as I want to be at any given moment of the GMing process. And so I would say in that way, yeah, you can develop some bad habits. I'd call them constrictive habits by running from the book, because it gets you to run by the letter of the law. Whereas I think the real joy of running tabletop RPGs is to have that freedom and that ability for you to be surprised, right? We love surprising the players, but the joy of DMing for me is being surprised myself, either by the adventure or by my players in turn. And playing more free-flowingly from notes rather than hard text really does that for me.
I think analogies are a horrible way to make a point, so let me make an analogy. To me, this is the same as saying, I want to write poetry, so should I read poetry or should I read a book about writing poetry? And the answer is both, because you are doing all of these things. It is not just one thing that you do when you create a campaign. It's many things. You can learn some of those things through trial and error. You can learn some of those things through direct instruction. You can learn some of those things by modeling on something else that you really enjoy and think is good. So reading adventures will help you formulate adventures, not necessarily write them. Maybe you're not going to publish them or even write them down for yourself, but you're doing it out of your head. But still, you can see a flow. You can see encounter building. You can see story formation. You can see story beats. You can see those sorts of things by reading a published adventure. Can you learn bad habits from that? Absolutely. But you can also learn wonderful things. Read a variety of different things. Even if you're only going to write sonnets, you still want to read haiku. You still want to read blank verse. You still want to read as many things as you can poetically to learn what you can and take from that to put into your own work.
I think it's also really, really valuable to try, if you're reading these things with a mind for what can I learn from it, just go in knowing that, you know, It's not a perfect thing. Go in and keep your mind on, okay, what do I like? What do I not like? What do I have questions about? How would that work in play at the table versus how it's written? You know, keep your critical mind's eye on the prize while you're doing it, because there is a lot of value in figuring out what you do and don't like about a thing. I will also say that in terms of different styles of adventure, I think there's only so much that you can learn from reading different Wizards of the Coast published adventures. Because to a certain degree, they are bound to trying to appeal to a much wider audience. And by necessity, that means that they can be less specific. But if you go to third party adventures, if you go and you read, Citadel of the Unseen Sun, that's a very different kind of adventure, right? That is a specific adventure. It's for a specific type of DM and player who want, you know, their dark fantasy game. And that's going to be different from, you know, an adventure that is published by another company that doesn't do their dark fantasy thing. You know, they do their cute little woodland creatures. What's that one called? That's Humblewood. Just been added to Humblewood. You know, if you get a Humblewood adventure, that's going to have a different kind of style and genre and story that they're trying to tell that is, again, going to be more specific. So make sure that you're branching out to reading adventures that are beyond sort of this core 5e vein. Even if they're not written for 5e, you can learn a lot from adventures that are written for other systems as well.
And different formats. Read a 2-page adventure, read a 1-page adventure.
Read
one where every encounter is, you know, 2 inches on the page, and then read one where the encounter takes up 5 pages and see the difference in how they're designed.
Writing one shots and running one shots is definitely a different art form from, you know, campaign or multi session adventures, in the same way that writing a short story or a one act play is different from writing a theatrical production or a novel or something like that. I think also, speaking of James Hake written adventures, I'm reading, and Sean Merwin written rules as well. I'm reading both Saga of the Seasons and Raiders Guide to Valakka at the moment, specifically for those raiding rules, which I'm taking completely out of context and using elsewhere. Forming an opinion when you're reading something to learn something, forming an opinion on the thing is not a bad thing to do. And then being like, ooh, and I can add this, that, and the other, you know, to it. I'm already kind of not breaking the rating rules, but kind of being like, oh, okay, I see how this is simulating X thing. Now I'm going to add this to it because it works in a similar way, but it's an alternative idea, you know, sort of things in there. I'm being vague deliberately because I'll probably make a video about this later in the year, but those are a fantastic mass combat rules, I think, for fighting over large regions of area.
You heard it here first. That video is coming out next week.
No, it's not. maybe in the middle of the year, maybe closer to when those books are getting into people's hands. Closer
next
to
week.
having a critical mind when you're reading adventures, I think it is useful, but knowing like, okay, how can I make this work for me? Because adventures, I think, as written, are like plays. Plays are not written to be read. Plays are written to be performed, you know? And the performance that one actor or one troupe brings to it is going to be very different to the performance that a different troupe brings to it. And so as a dungeon master or a director, to strain this analogy a little bit, your job is to interpret the text and then present it to the players, who will then interpret it again and play within that world, as opposed to how do I make this as close to what the writer intended as possible. It doesn't matter what the writer intended after a point. What matters is how you are going to interpret, present, enjoy these adventures as written. Late breaking news. Dale, when you think of the illustrious tabletop RPG publishing companies within our industry, what's one of the top ones you think of? One of the greatest, one of the greats.
Oh God, what does he want me to say? What does he want me to say? Because
anyone at all.
It feels like a trap, Benjamin.
Sean Merwin, when you think of the great tabletop RPG publishers, who would you be excited to see an adventure from?
Modiphius.
That's right. NASA have released a tabletop RPG product. Nautical Academy of Space Ascendancy, whatever NASA stands for.
Well, that's it.
have released. I'm just reading this for the first time. Dante just dropped it into our Discord. So let me interest you. Calling to adventurers. It's time to gather your party and your favorite tabletop role-playing game system. Oh, system agnostic. I like this so far. A dark mystery, up my alley. Has settled over the city of Aldastron on the rogue planet of Exlaris. Researchers dedicated studying the cosmos have disappeared. and the Hubble Space Telescope has vanished from Earth's timeline. Only an ambitious crew of adventurers can uncover what was lost. Are you up to the challenge? This adventure is designed for a party of 4 to 7, level 7 to 10 characters, and easily adaptable to your preferred tabletop role-playing system.
I want to play some level 7 to 10 Call of Cthulhu characters.
Just going to say.
Oh,
I was just going to say, this sounds like a Cthulhu-ish haunted space adventure. And then they said level 7 to 10. Heist, level 7 to 10.
Yes.
Perfect.
You play NASA bears have gone into space.
We could make it work.
Let's do this.
NASA releasing a tabletop RPG adventure invites you to take on a classic villain while also using and learning science skills.
Who wrote it?
Designed by a woman named Christina Mitchell, who a brief Google search turns up nothing about.
Mysterious.
I can't believe you tracked that down. I've been trying to track it down.
It's like it's the last page of their PDF, yeah. Basically, their credits page.
Maybe they are the villain of this adventure.
Christina Mitchell did it.
I love and respect Christina Mitchell, whom I know nothing about.
God, there's just a blueprint for the Hubble telescope in here.
What?
Appendix C. It's a blueprint of the Hubble Space Telescope.
That's the whole adventure. It's just a blueprint.
Great.
They talk about this. They talk about
this,
blue
right?
shifting in here. The Einstein ring.
We have to
what
play
what is going
this?
On? Wow. I love this.
Using our science skills at the same time. Yeah. James, you've accessed it. It's a free PDF. Is that the case?
It's free.
Check it out if you want. Or if you want to check out this podcast next week, we will be back at 7 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern time on a Monday, or on a Tuesday, Australia, 10 a.m. Is the times that this records live on Twitch. Otherwise, you can find us on YouTube. You might be watching this on YouTube. You might be listening to this in your ear holes right now from Spotify or some other podcasting platform. Giving likes, thumbs ups, comments, stars, whatever your platform desires feeds our eldritch power and is very much appreciated. Appreciate everyone in chat hanging out with us today. And we will be back next week. I've been Ben Byrne here with James Hake, Dale Kingsmill, Sean Merwin. And we hope to see you all again next week for another episode of the Eldritch.
This might be my least favorite, NPC voice you've ever done.
I was just thinking about the other one that you don't like. I'm like, there's a little bit like some get through.
You know what? Actually,
down.
In comparison, turns out I love that one.
Great. That's the end of the episode. Goodbye.
Get out of here. Yeah. It's over. Go.
There's no post-credits scene.